Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Healthy Carolinians webinar series. Today's webinar is Improving Health Through Policy with Dr. Adam Zalator, who is the President and CEO of NC Institute of Medicine. I wanted to start today's webinar with a few logistics. If you have problems accessing the audio or visual portion of this webinar, you can call 919-357-8990. This webinar is being recorded, and the presentation and audio slides will be archived on the CareShare website. All lines are currently muted and will be muted during the presentation. If you have a question, you can type it into the question and answer section in the GoToWebinar control panel, or you can hit *7 to unmute yourself on the phone. The webinar series is a partnership between CareShare Health Alliance and Population Health Improvement Partners. Our partnership goal is to facilitate communication, support collaborations, share best practices, and provide technical assistance. The series is held on the second Wednesday of the month, generally from 10 to 11 a.m. Our missions. CareShare Health Alliance mission is to work with state and local partners to facilitate and foster collaborative networks and models that improve health of underserved people in North Carolina. Population Health Improvement Partners' mission is to build community and organizational capacity to improve and sustain population health. I wanted to share the upcoming webinars. In January, we will have a webinar on understanding county health rankings. And on February 10th, it will be the Alliance for a Healthier Generation's Healthy Schools program. At the end of the webinar today, there will be an evaluation. Please provide feedback about today's webinar, and this also gives us an opportunity to find out what other webinars you are interested in seeing and learning about. So with that said, I am going to turn it over to Adam Zalator. Adam, we hit *7 to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Well, thanks so much for the invitation. And I think you're going to give me control of the webinar, right, Megan?
I am. I'm doing that right now.
Fabulous. And hopefully in a few seconds you all will be able to see my slides. I'm trying to pull it up in slideshow mode. But sometimes in GoToMeeting it goes a little slow at first. Well, I'll go ahead and jump in and say I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak at this webinar and to talk to you a little bit about our experience with policy at the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. I also appreciate your flexibility in being able to move this webinar to the afternoon. It made it a lot easier for me today, and I'm really glad to be able to do this. I think that, you know, what you'll see, what I'm going to try and talk about is mostly where we've been successful at moving state health policy, what our experience has been, what I think are the factors that influence our success, and what are the things that impede our success, and a little bit of sort of more kind of, you know, what can I do as a resident of my community or a health professional in my community to influence the local and state health policy process. And many of these, I think, are probably going to be things that you all do or know about or know you should do. And I think that's always kind of one of the biggest problems. I know I should be talking to my legislator, but I don't, or they don't seem interested in talking to me, or Do they really read my emails, that kind of thing. So we'll try and talk a little bit about our experience and where this may be able to inform your work. All right, so hopefully everybody is seeing my slides. Megan, can you see my slides?
Yes, I can see them, and they are moving, so
perfect.
We're good.
Good. So this is just about us, for those of you who are not familiar with our work. I always feel like a disadvantage when I do these webinars because I bet that I've met half of you, and I don't know who you are because I can't see the attendee list. So if you're not familiar with our work, we're a quasi-state agency. We were chartered in 1983 by the General Assembly to be concerned with the health of the people of North Carolina, monitor and study health matters, respond authoritatively when found advisable, and respond to requests from outside resources for analysis and advice when this will aid in forming a basis for health policy decisions. So we've been doing this work for about 32 years. I think that we have had some fabulous successes and some I was going to say unmitigated failures, but how about mitigated failures? We've certainly found our challenges, and we'll talk a little bit why that is. One thing that I want to say at the onset is that we consider policy to operate at a lot of different levels, and I think that when most of us think of state health policy, we sort of think about lawmaking in the General Assembly first, and that's certainly a kind of state health policy that we're very concerned with and involved with. I think that we also think about the way laws are implemented or executive policy, and we work on a weekly, if not daily, basis with partners in executive agencies, most often in divisions of the Department of Health and Human Services, but also in the Department of Commerce, the Department of Public Instruction, et cetera. And so executive policy is definitely an important part of what we do. But the other thing that is sometimes initially less obvious to people is that what we sometimes talk about as small p policy is the policy at the community level, at the practice level, at the level of educational institutions. And for those of you who have been involved with our work or seen our work products over time, if you look at any one of our reports, you'll see anywhere from 15 to 40 recommendations, and usually about half of them are sort of that big P state health policy, which is targeted at the General Assembly or executive agencies. But then we also might have recommendations to academic health centers or to the North Carolina Medical Society or to LME-MCOs or to the North Carolina Psychiatric Association. So there are lots of different partners that are involved. We actually might have recommendations to CareShare Health Alliance and often have, or CareShare Health Alliance in partnership with other groups that are doing the kind of work at the community level that might be part of implementing some what we would consider local policy, and that could be at the sort of county commissioner level, but it could also be at the practice or grassroots level. So we have two primary vehicles that we think about in terms of impacting state health policy, and the two things that I think most people know us for are our work around task forces and our publication of the North Carolina Medical Journal. And I'm going to talk about both of these in somewhat more detail in a few minutes, but I also wanted to just mention that there are lots of other ways that we participate in the state health policy process, and and sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it's maybe even a little bit behind the scenes, and not to be secretive about it, but sometimes it's a little less obvious. So there are things that we do, like publishing with NC Child the Child Health Report Card each year. We think that has sort of a more covert influence on policy by helping with the dissemination of information on health indicators of children in the state of North Carolina. We will often publish other shorter policy pieces. We used to do on a regular basis snapshots of the uninsured. We might get asked to do a smaller study by a legislative study section or by an executive agency that might not be a full-scale report, but it may be a review of some relevant health data in North Carolina. We are often asked for advice, and I could give you a number of examples. I typically receive a phone call on average about once a month or once every other month from somebody in an executive agency or somebody in the General Assembly or occasionally from one of our U.S. senators' offices. So in the last year, I've been on the phone with somebody from Senator Tillis's office, Secretary Brazier, Representative Insko, around Governor McCrory's election and installation into the governorship. We had probably weekly discussions with members of his transition team talking about Medicaid expansion and implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And we typically try to position ourselves as a source of nonpartisan information. So we will get a request, again, from the governor or somebody in his administration about the effect of I remember there was a lot of discussion about the effect of welfare on in-migration. So they wanted to know, what do we know about from the research literature on if states have richer welfare or TANF benefits, do people move to those states to benefit from those resources? And the analogy was, if we are the only state in the Southeast that expands Medicaid, are we vulnerable to having people move to North Carolina because of a richer Medicaid benefit? And I think that, you know, what we tried to do was provide the information in the most objective way possible. It's always, of course, hard not to editorialize, but I think that to be a trusted resource from information in a bipartisan way, we have to try to, present facts when they're requested. The other thing that we do at the Institute on a pretty regular basis, this probably happens once or twice a month, is to respond to requests for information from the media. So we'll often serve as a resource to partners in the media, and this is, probably mostly larger statewide papers. I would say the News and Observer or the Charlotte Observer, the Asheville Citizen Times, the Greensboro Record. Those are the kinds of papers that we get called from somewhat regularly, and also NC Health News on a pretty regular basis, and sometimes NC Education News. So we try to be as responsive as possible to partners in the media and partners in executive and legislative agencies. So this question comes up pretty often. Why do you choose to study the things that you choose to study? So this is, again, going back to our task forces, one of our kind of main work products and one of the primary ways that we influence state health policy. And we sort of come to our topics by any one of a number of mechanisms. We might get a request from the General Assembly. That used to be more common. Right now, that is less common. We often get requests from state agencies, and that still seems to be happening about once a year. We will often get requests from foundations, and that tends to happen about once a year. We'll sometimes get requests to take on an issue from a health professional organization, another nonprofit organization, or the North Carolina Institute of Medicine board or staff. And I can tell you, as I run through some of our more recent task forces, exactly sort of how we came to take on that task force. I am going to be focusing on task forces where we have a little bit more information on success. So I can tell you the work that we're doing right now, we have two ongoing task forces, one on Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and this was a task force that was legislatively required of the Department of Health and Human Services. The Department of Health and Human Services passed it to the Division of Aging and Adult Services, and I asked the Division on Aging, is this something that we could play a useful role? Could we be helpful? And they said, absolutely, we would love to partner with you to do this. And then it became an issue of finding the resources to carry out the work, which was then mostly my responsibility. Our other current task force is on mental health and substance abuse with a focus on adolescents and older adults, and that was done at the request of KP Reynolds Charitable Trust. They approached us and said, would you do this? Do you have capacity? Do you have interest? And we said, yeah, we're interested. We'd like to know, you know, if this is a good time and what kind of opportunities we have with the Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities and Substance Abuse Services. So that was sort of our next call, and we were able, after a series of discussions, to identify some areas that we could focus on where we thought we would be able to leverage some influence. So for those of you who have not been involved in task forces, these are broad-based groups of stakeholders, usually between 30 and 60 people. Our work is guided by a smaller steering committee, and meetings are open to the public. One of the things that I think winds up being the most important part of this process is who we invite to the table as stakeholders. And I've had a number of task force members who have compared our process to the National Institute of Medicine process, and I think that the real difference is that the National Academy Institute of Medicine is really a group of experts that are more academic experts and may know the topic area and the research better than anybody else in the country. But they generally don't engage stakeholders that are responsible for the political or practical parts of the process. So we really try to engage experts in the way we typically think of them as academics or practice experts. But we also understand that to move things forward, we need to work with our political representatives, members of executive agencies, maybe the implementers. So I have here listed people like health professionals, maybe insurers, the business community, the faith community, community leaders, consumer groups, and other interested individuals. And by consumer groups, I mean typically these are more like patients or caregivers or patient representatives, and it may depend on the issue. It may be staff from NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. It may be people receiving treatment. On our Alzheimer's task force, we have two caregivers, as well as representation from AARP, a consumer group. So we try to have, again, a broad coalition. And I think that, one of my jobs when we start a task force is to think, where might we go with recommendations, and who might I need to carry water on those recommendations at the end of the day, and let me engage them at the beginning of the process rather than at the end of the process. And I can tell you that we do a decent job at this, but it's an imperfect process. And I'll give you an example. We had a children's oral health task force this ended probably about two and a half years ago. And we invited somebody from the Board of Dental Examiners to be on the task force. And we went through probably three different invitations trying to get somebody to represent the Board of Dental Examiners. And, and that process took place over about two or so months. And then we were starting, and we let that go. And it was probably really more an omission, because as we're gearing up for a task force, we have lots of balls in the air. It didn't seem that they were interested. We were having trouble engaging somebody from the dental board. And so we never probably followed up on the last lead. And as it turned out, there was a recommendation that was very particular to the Board of Dental Examiners. And it is a recommendation that we're still struggling with implementation. And I think that we would have been more successful if we had somebody from the dental board participating in the beginning. We had lots of dentists, but we didn't have a dental board member. That was an important distinction and something that we should have addressed at the beginning rather than trying to play catch up at the end. This is just a little bit more information about sort of the process. The staff and other experts synthesize information and evidence and usually share presentations for the purposes of task force. information and deliberation. We typically try to balance task force meetings between the presentation or sharing of information and discussion, really wanting to take advantage of task force members as experts, but trying to get everybody to the same sort of basic fund of knowledge, since stakeholders come at their expertise from different perspectives. Again, our task force recommendations are aimed at lots of different audiences. We've already talked a little bit about this, and we do what's called an update 3 to 5 years after a task force report is published, in which we look at the success of implementation, and typically between 50 and 90% of our recommendations are partially or entirely implemented, again, around 5 years out. So just an idea of some of our recent work. Patient and family engagement is something that we completed in March of 2015. You can see we did this in partnership with the North Carolina Quality Center, Medical Society, CCNC, Foundation for Nursing Excellence, and it was funded by the Duke Endowment, Essentials for Childhood. I will say that the patient and family engagement was an idea generated by staff internally. Again, just to the point of where our ideas for work come from. The Essentials for Childhood was sort of a reprisal of our 2005 Child Maltreatment Prevention Task Force. This was done as part of a year one planning grant from the Centers for Disease Control, done as a subcontract to the Division of Public Health. And the Rural Health Action Plan was published in 2014. This was done at the request of the Office of Rural Health and the KP Reynolds Charitable Trust. So, again, this one came from an executive agency and a funder. I want to I think I'm going to just skip this slide in the interest of making sure we have time for discussion. I'm certainly happy to share these slides, but this is other recently completed studies. You can see just, you know, we've worked on obesity prevention, oral health services, the Affordable Care Act, early childhood social emotional well-being, implementing evidence-based strategies in local health departments, and developing a suicide prevention and intervention plan. And some common themes to our recent work are around expanding access to healthcare, coverage of the uninsured, strengthening of the safety net, and improving access for underserved communities. I know that's those are probably issues that are important to the folks on the webinar today. We also talk a lot about quality and efficiency in care and improving population health with a focus on health promotion and primary prevention, chronic disease management, and the importance of social determinants of health on health outcomes. We've also done work in developing new delivery systems, with a focus on interdisciplinary teams, alternative payment structures, and development of mental health developmental disability and substance abuse service systems of care, as well as a focus on the development of and implementation of evidence-based or evidence-informed strategies with attention to fidelity. So I did that kind of fast because I think that for today's talk, I wanted to get more into the next set of slides, which is really sort of more speaks to how and where we've been effective. And I'd invite you, if you're interested in any of these topics, these are all updates that we have published online. So you can look at our website at nciom.org and find our primary care and specialty supply update. Where recommendation by recommendation, you'll be able to see of our, I think this had about 34 recommendations, which one have been partially implemented, which ones have been fully implemented, and what exactly has happened in the 6 years between publication of report and publication of the update. And so I've pulled out, I've sort of given you an overall score, and then I've pulled out one or a couple of sort of really high-profile examples, and so keep in mind that you know this is that I'm just bragging here. So these are some of our best examples and things that I am pretty proud of. Even though some of this stuff predated me, some of it is still ongoing. So in the primary care and specialty supply work that we did in 2007, We had made progress on 76% of recommendations. And typically, if you unpack that, which I haven't for this slide, usually about 30 or 40% of the recommendations that have been implemented are fully implemented, and the other 60 to 70% of recommendations are progress towards implementation. And I'll tell you, we don't do a 10-year update, but I've occasionally looked at some of these updates, curious what's happened 5 years later. And what we find is that when there's progress on implementation at the five-year mark, there's usually continued progress over the next 5 years. Things where there have been no progress at the five-year mark tend to be things that have continued to not have traction over the five subsequent years. One of the things that I think has been most impressive with regard to the Primary Care and Specialty Supply Task Force is the expansion of clinician training programs. And so Campbell Medical School will speak often and loudly on our behalf, saying how important our recommendation to expand the number of physicians that we train in North Carolina by 30% was responsible for the development of the new osteopathic medical school in Booth Creek. And part of that has been being able to go to the Board of Trustees at Campbell to be able to fundraise. Part of that was influencing a large grant from KP Reynolds Charitable Trust. And so I think that helping them develop the case and provide sort of, you know, the expert backing that this is something that's important that North Carolina needs to be doing was really important for them developing that medical school. That is not, again, big P policy. That is really more small P policy. And most of my other examples I've tried to focus on legislative or executive policy. We'll, in addition, have 70 new slots at UNC and ECU and 3 new campuses. More importantly, or at least as importantly, since the publication of this report, there are 7 new physician's assistant programs and 6 new nurse practitioner programs. And I don't want to sit here and tell you that we're responsible for all of these, and I have not talked to the deans of the schools of health at all of these programs, but I've talked to some of them, and many of them did rely on our report to be thinking about planning for the growth of their campuses after 2007. So I think that, again, can't take full responsibility, but I think that this was an important part of the conversation for many of the new PA and NP programs. About half or so of these are at private campuses like Elon and High Point and Lenoir Rhine, and about half are on UNC system campuses. So UNCW is a program that I visited a couple of weeks ago. But Chapel Hill has a new PA program about to come online. So, again, probably a little bit more than half are private and a little less than half are public. So the next report that I wanted to mention was our adolescent health report. That was done in 2009 with an update in 2012. Here we made progress or complete implementation of 72% of recommendations. And this is one where I think our ability to influence legislative policy was really important. One of the recommendations was around increasing high school graduation rate, and you can see in 2008 we had a 70.3% high school graduation rate. In 2012 we had an 80.2% high school graduation rate. In the most recent child health report card, I think that's quite a bit higher, actually. We've continued to make substantial progress. And there are a variety of legislative initiatives and DPI initiatives that, again, happened subsequent to this report that are at least in part due to conversations that started around this task force. And one of the things that I think we can take some credit for is the recurring funding and dropout prevention that was appropriated by the by the General Assembly for $13 million a year. This has just had a really substantial impact on high school graduation rate, and I kind of purposely pointed to this one because I think that at the Institute, we believe social determinants of health are incredibly important, at least as important as access, if not more important than access. So I think that even though sometimes to some of our partners the link isn't obvious, we think that this is certainly part of what we need to be talking about in thinking about health policy. The next report I wanted to point to was our chronic kidney disease study, and that was published in 2008 with an update in 2012. Here again, we made progress on 73% of recommendations. This was really, really heavily clinical, and nothing that I could say was clearly state health policy with a big P. But we know that there was an increase in education around the management and referral of chronic kidney disease. There were a number of CCNC initiatives and pilot projects that came out subsequent to this report. There was education through the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians and AHAC that came out subsequent to this report. And then one of the things that's very, very clinical is this management of the glomerular filtration rate, or the GFR, and the way it's measured and reported. We were seeing some labs start to report the GFR in 2008, but it's become universally adopted since 2008, consistent with best practice nationally. And I think that we were probably able to, again, influence that discussion at our academic labs, large hospital labs, and our reference labs that we use in North Carolina. All right, so just a couple more. We had an oral health literacy task force in 2007 with an update in 2010, and we made progress on 79% of the recommendations. And one of the ones that I wanted to point to, there were several that were around legislative appropriation. You'll notice the timing here was not wonderful for legislative appropriation, and so none of those appropriation recommendations from this task force were implemented, but we did have success with implementing a standardized process for the review of health information from North Carolina Department of Health and Human Service divisions to make information more accessible for lower health literacy populations. And so I think that's a good executive policy and process that's improved our statewide access to information. We did a nursing study in 2004 with an update in 2007, and here we made progress or complete implementation on 89% of recommendations. I picked a lot because there were so many things that were successful, and many of these were big P policy initiatives. We were able to influence appropriation for the Nursing Faculty Fellows Program with $1.2 million in appropriations for 2 years to get the program off the ground. And this is really a program looking at training doctorate level nurses for nursing faculty across the state. We also had recommendations for expanding nursing doctorate programs, and there were two new programs subsequent to this report, and about 2.5 times the number of students matriculated in nursing doctorate level programs. This was an interesting recommendation and something I don't know very much about, but we had a recommendation to designate nursing programs at the community college as high-cost programs, and high-cost programs receive additional appropriations because it's just higher to run those programs. And there's some sort of a standard formula for an increased appropriations for these programs. And we asked the General Assembly to consider this as a high-cost program. They did not designate nursing as a high-cost program, but they did establish what was called weighted funding for an additional $1 million in appropriations towards the nursing programs, which fell short of what we expected appropriations should have been if they were a high-cost program, but was certainly an important additional boost to resources for those programs. There had also been funding cuts to the UNC system nursing programs, and we recommended restoring that funding, and that funding was restored. We also recommended establishing a matriculation agreement between the RN to from RN programs to BSN programs, from community college campuses to four-year universities. And in 2007, this had started to happen, but you all know of the wild success of the ribbon program now, with every university having matriculation agreements from community college nursing programs. I think that there are 17 ribbon programs and probably thousands of bachelor's level nurses that have been prepared using using the ribbon program, with an increased demand from hospital systems. And so I think this has been wildly successful, and I would say that this report helped lay that groundwork. Couple more. I think that particularly the uninsured and safety net report may be of interest to this group. And I think this was published in 2006. And the update was published in 2008. There was progress made on 75% of safety net recommendations and 62% of the uninsured recommendations. One example was legislative funding to expand and strengthen the community health grants and the health net funding. The folks on the webinar probably know a lot more about that than I do. The last one that I'll mention is the Child Abuse Prevention Program. This report was published in 2005 with an update in 2008, with progress made in 75% of the recommendations. And most of the successes were around the implementation of evidence-based programs. When we did the update, there had been a number of small grants to look at feasibility for implementing nurse-family partnership. In 2005, we had one nurse-family partnership program in Guilford County in North Carolina. Now I believe we have 17, and I attribute that almost entirely to this report. It wasn't all up and running in 2008, but we were well on our way. There's been a marked increase in state funding, private appropriations from philanthropy, and more recently federal funding for evidence-based home visiting programs. And so I think that there's been a lot of success around child maltreatment prevention. And my slide is frozen, so I'm going to be patient for a minute. If I was smart enough to print these out, I would be able to keep talking. Megan, if you have any ideas, chime in. But
yes.
I know when this happens, it usually just requires patience.
Doesn't seem to be frozen on my side. I can see your mouse moving, so it's not frozen on my end.
Yeah, it's just that the slides are not advancing. One thing I can do is go to this. Let's see, sometimes that'll...
Yeah.
That's working. Okay. So I think I'm here. Let's see if we can go back to the full view. Nope. Oh, there we go. Okay, good.
Yeah, that works.
All right. So, again, I've mentioned a lot of this. I think that some of what's made us successful is bringing a wide range of stakeholders and other interested parties to study an issue in neutral territory. We try to pick issues when there is room for compromise and an opportunity for success, and where there are groups that want to work to make a difference. The best example of this, and my predecessor Pam Silberman used to say, we had a member of our board who every year would say, you need to study tort reform. And she would say, I'm happy to study tort reform, but we'd have to have at least as many trial lawyers in the room as we have healthcare providers in the room. And I don't think there's any room for compromise, so I'm not sure what the compromise or what the win is, and I'm not sure either group really wants to work with the other on this issue right now. And so we never studied tort reform. But when somebody comes to me and says, when you think about looking at this issue, the first thing I try to do is to figure out, well, what are the sides? Who has the position, the positions, and how entrenched are those positions? What are the political opportunities and pitfalls? And if it seems like a place where, again, there's opportunity for us to work, bring people together, and find compromise to move an issue forward, then those are the kinds of things that we want to work on. We do use research and evidence to inform policy options, and we involve stakeholder groups in supporting and implementing those recommendations. And I think that, you know, I could reflect on a host of specific examples, but I want to make sure that we have some time for questions. So I'm gonna keep moving, and maybe we'll get to some of those examples during questions. So I do want to reflect on some of our recent challenges. As we all know, it's been a difficult fiscal and political climate for the last 5 years or so. And I wanted to just mention our prevention action plan. We are working on our update right now. We have said that we've made progress, I think, on 79% of recommendations. And so it was actually pretty happy at the end of that. But when we started the process, there were 17 of, I think, 32 recommendations would ask for appropriations, of which almost none. We instead of a recurring appropriation, we had one-time $1.5 million appropriation that came out of that plan. But we had asked for 17 different appropriations for $200 million total of recurring funds, which is a huge amount of money for new spending from the General Assembly. And so I think I can say this because I wasn't part of the task force or the institute. I think that was a very ambitious plan that was published at exactly the worst time. And so that's just important to own that sometimes timing is everything. We've had market changes over the last 5 or so years in executive and legislative branches. We've had a newly appointed board of directors, which has gone very well. We had historically had a self-perpetuating board, and about 3 years ago we had our enabling legislation amended to create a board that was appointed by the governor, the Senate pro tem, and the Speaker of the House. And we had some anxiety about how things might be different. And again, I think our new board has been great, and I think it's important to be able to work with leadership across both sides of the aisle, and I think that our new board has been helpful in making new connections and leveraging a different kind of leadership and experience. I would say that we've had very variable engagement with legislators, and I sat on a task force in 2005. And we had very active and involved legislators, and that was something that we had been doing for a while and continued to do for a while. I think that my predecessor had begun to feel like our legislators were accepting an invitation to sit on a task force, and then they were not very involved, and it had become less helpful. And so for the first several task forces I was involved in, we didn't have members of the General Assembly on the task force, and we've started doing that again. And I continue to believe that's very important. I think, you know, we're typically making anywhere from 3 to 10 recommendations that might involve legislation, and I think that you can get advice from legislators on what they think will fly, where they think their caucuses sit on a particular issue, and how to navigate you know, finding a legislative champion, who should propose it, what lobbying groups you might work with to try to influence the legislative process. So I think that getting those legislators in our court early and asking for their opinion and expertise is really important. And I would say that we have had very good engagement with legislators on our Mental Health and Substance Abuse Task Force, our Essentials for Childhood Task Force, and our Alzheimer's Disease Task Force. We always invite 4 legislators. If we invite anybody, we will have a Democrat and a Republican from both houses, and not all 4 of them are equally engaged, and that's okay. We have task force members from other sectors that are, you know, that never show up to a meeting, and then others that show up to every single meeting. So I think engagement across the board is variable. I think that I'm actually shocked at how good engagement is, because when we ask somebody to be on a task force, it's a 5-hour meeting once a month, usually for a year, and people mostly say yes to the invitation, and I would say that our average task force member comes to 80% of the meetings or calls in for 80% of the meetings. So I think that level of voluntary commitment and dedication is really, in large part, what we owe our success to. And just want to mention quickly the North Carolina Medical Journal as another vehicle by which we influence policy. I have just title of slides, you can see what kinds of issues we've been involved in. Sometimes these will run parallel to a task force. Sometimes, more often, they're entirely different topics. Cancer care, long-term care, improving population health, rural health, traumatic brain injury, patient and family engagement, evidence-based practice, military health was our most recent issue. In January, we're going to have an issue focused just on research. Our March-April issue is on workforce, May-June on gastroenterology, and July-August is going to be focused on pay-for-value. So one of the things that we try to do is intersperse more clinical issues with more policy-heavy issues. And this is just Adam's sort of rendition on Schoolhouse Rock, how a bill becomes a law. Hopefully y'all remember, because I'm not going to sing for you this afternoon. I think it's important to, as you all are interested in influencing statewide policy, to think about where legislative advocacy plays a role and how it evolves. And there are always it's always a little bit of an opaque process. And I've often said there are some bills that I'd really like to be a fly on the wall or a spy on the bill so that I can understand what really happens. The legislative process is very, very mysterious to me. I have a couple of examples. These are very heavily clinical. Probably 3 years ago, North Carolina started requiring universal congenital heart disease screening. So every baby born in North Carolina hospitals has to have a pulse ox measurement before they leave the hospital. The clinical details of this are not important, but suffice it to say that there was one study. It was a good study, but it was, in my mind, not a definitive conclusion that this should be legislated health policy for all. I think it's something that hospital systems and healthcare providers should be thinking about. So I went back when I read that this had passed and tried to figure out exactly how this happened. And it seemed to me that there was little in terms of legislative testimony from doctors, pediatric cardiologists, epidemiologists. And it seemed to me what carried water on this bill was testimony from a Carolina Panther football player who had a baby that died of congenital heart disease, which may or may not have been diagnosed by ultrasound, which may or may not have been diagnosed if this baby had pulse oximetry screening. But it was interesting to me the importance of a story and the importance of that story being from a superstar. I think that really has a lot of influence in the legislative process. Now, whether or not there was effective lobbying and money that went along with that story and that superstar, I don't know. Another good example of sort of the importance of an individual story is a bill proposed by a senator or representative from Guilford County. I think it may be Gladys Robinson. She had a constituent who, as an infant, died of type 1 diabetes. And so she proposed universal screening with blood sugar measurement for all infants in North Carolina as a bill during the long session. And this bill did get good input from the physician community and the public health community, and where legislators were given the recommendation that universal diabetes screening would be expensive and of low yield and is not an evidence-based screen for infants. And so what did pass, I believe, was a version of this bill which recommends education on diabetes symptoms to the parents of all infants. So it became a much sort of more watered-down version of what was originally proposed. But the whole bill got on the legislative agenda because of a constituent's tragedy. I think that it's most hopeful and most effective when a good story is backed up by good data, and I think that there's a lot of legislative interest on return on investment data. The Child Fatality Task Force has been interested in juvenile justice programs using the Washington State Institute for Public Policy Results First model, which is a model that compares programs in a particular sector like juvenile justice based on costs and benefits that would be realized in a particular local environment. So they'll do analysis based on the situation on the ground in North Carolina. And so there's some interest in moving forward with that kind of model. Usually, a model like the WISIP model might direct legislators to invest more money in some areas and less money in other areas. And so I think that's important to recognize. And germane to my next bullet point, legislation is more palatable to our General Assembly right now if funds are not requested, or if funds are required for a program, that there be some discussion of a shift in priorities. If you want more money for something, what do you want less money for? And I think it's important that we own that. I will tell you that, you know, we've been hearing that in North Carolina since 2009, roughly, that there is no new money. But we should remember that the state of North Carolina's budget did grow by $1.5 billion in the current budget from the last long session. So we are growing our economy, and we are growing our state budget, our state government budget, and we are growing services. So I think it's on healthcare providers, consumers, and policymakers to think about the most important priorities for new investments, and they'll still be few and far between. But there are new resources to be investing in healthcare policy. I do think developing a legislative champion is important, and then I think I think figuring out who can really carry the day, who is able to lobby, and who might share an interest. This is advice I recently got from a representative around a current recommendation we have. It's to really think, you know, so this is what the recommendation is. We have a recommendation coming out in support of a more robust 211 system. And so we had the discussion, who else would benefit from a more robust 211 system? What other interest groups? And we started talking about how local law enforcement might be one group that has a lobbying interest in a 211 system. And energy companies also have a strong interest in a robust 211 system, because most calls to 211 are for energy assistance, and Duke Energy has contributed pretty significantly to the development of the local 211 system in the southwestern part of the state. So I think that hadn't actually occurred to me. We don't have those people around the table at our task force, and so now it's my job to approach them and see if they're interested in helping with this, you know, adding this to their legislative agenda, maybe for 2017. All right, so this is just, you know, my thoughts about being involved at the local level. And again, I think that, you know, these are things that many of you probably do, or if you don't do them, you know, you should. I think that voting, I think contributing to political campaigns if you're able, always supporting stakeholders with information, with data, if you have access to data. Some of you all, I suspect, because of the work you do, have very real, powerful access to consumers with stories that they need to tell that are really important, especially during an election season. Being able to offer candidates an opportunity to speak during election season, developing relationships with your local representatives, providing information to local papers, and getting to know your legislators, legislative aides. And I think we've talked about all this, so I want to at least leave a little bit of time for questions. So, Megan, remind me how you want to run questions. Okay. I know you, that some people may have been sending them to you, and
yes.
People can unmute.
Right. So if you have a question, you can unmute by hitting *7 and asking your question directly to Adam, or you can type a question in the GoTo webinar control panel. So while folks are thinking about questions, Adam, when you talked about at one point, you know, working on policy levels, level around social determinants of health, and that some folks may not be interested in that as some others may be, how do you frame that conversation? Do you have any tips for framing conversation so that it's more nonpartisan?
Well, I think that the first thing I'd say is that I don't believe the concept of social determinants of health is partisan. I think that language might be. I mean, it's funny. I've often been given the advice around lots of terms that use the adjective social to avoid the adjective social and come up with a synonym, okay, which may sound a little bit ridiculous, but we talked about social impact bonds at a recent task force, and there's an alternative. I think it's like it's pay for value. Is the pay for value funding is a synonym. We've talked a lot about social norms, and we struggled to come up with a synonym for social norms. And I think that there is not a lot of taste for the adjective social. So again, social determinants might be the wrong term. I'm not sure. So I guess what I would do is I'd avoid that, and I'd say what it is that I'm interested in. And what I usually say is that, that we believe 20% of health is influenced by access, 20% of health is influenced by genes and biology, and 60% of health is influenced by the environment you live in and and health behaviors, and that I think it is one role of state and local government to make sure that the environment that we live in is conducive to health, and there are lots of ways that we can talk about that. And I also think it's the role of state government to make it easy for people to make the right choices. That's how I talk about health behavior, because I think that like. I don't think there's a lot of taste for taxing sweetened soft drinks, which I may be a big fan of, but I don't think that's of interest to people. But I do think that making sure people have options for buying healthy fruits and vegetables, I think there is a lot of taste for that. So I think it depends. Yeah, so I guess I talk about the issue. I avoid the use of the word social determinants, and I talk about the enormous contribution to health of environmental and community factors and health behaviors. I also want to say, Megan, that it's not that people. I was referring to. I don't remember the context exactly that I said that in. But what I meant. Oh, this was about high school graduation and how that might not be obviously connected to health for some people. A lot of our constituents are healthcare providers, healthcare professionals, and and a family doctor working, wherever might not necessarily see that as obviously connected to his or her work, which doesn't mean that he or she doesn't think it's important or that you can't, talk about why that's important and influence that person. But I think that I guess I was making the point that we at the Institute do feel like those are extremely important issues.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions? I see nothing in the chat box, but
right,
I'm not sure
yeah.
if I could.
This is Wilona with NC Get Covered. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Wilona.
Hi.
And really, I think folks aren't asking questions because you did such a great job with the presentation, because honestly, I think you've already answered the question that I'm about to ask. But I think that you all have a wonderful track record. The fact that 50 to 90% of your recommendations are partially or fully implemented, you said within 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But could you talk to, like, some of the recommendations that are, you know, they get no traction at all, and what are some of the common reasons for that?
Yeah.
I think you touched on it on the challenges slide.
Yeah, I'd be thrilled to. So I think that the number one reason that our recommendations don't get traction would be because they require legislative appropriation.
Yeah.
I think that the number two reason that our recommendations don't get traction are because they require some other kind of legislative action,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't develop the legislative champion to
right.
carry water on that.
Right.
But then there are lots of other reasons. I think, you know, one of the things that I spend a tremendous amount of time on kind of towards the end of a task force process is making sure that I am touching base with somebody from every group who's going to be named in a recommendation. And it's a conversation like, you know, what do you think about this recommendation? This is what came out of the task force. Is this constructive? Do you think this is helpful to you? Is there a way that you would make it more constructive? Am I missing something? Do we need resources to come to bear on this recommendation? You know, I think it's hard to tell people to do things that cost money without giving them money. Of course, then if they need resources, we have to figure out where that comes from. And you know, usually we have foundation partners at the table, and sometimes they're appropriate to ask, you know, and that's usually part of the conversation towards the end of every task force. I'm trying to think of what are the other sort of stumbling blocks. So a good example of that would be the Board of Dental Examiners and not having them fully on board at the time of publication of a report. I think another stumbling block is, I would say, broadly speaking, turnover is a huge challenge for us. And, you know, we've seen in the last couple of years turnover in, you know, lots of state agencies, some local agencies, some in the NGO sector, you know, hospital and health system administration. So turnover is a problem broadly. And another problem broadly is that, you know, we will develop a recommendation because it's really important to the stakeholders on our task force. And we will, you know, hopefully have somebody from that organization on the task force. And if not, work with them around the dissemination of the report to make sure that they understand it was important to the task force and get some response from them and try to work with them to make it a priority. But I think what we see is sometimes political priorities get in the way. And I think that there's been a lot going on in the last 6 months that have affected state agencies, the General Assembly, and trade associations from talking about anything but Medicaid reform. And Medicaid reform is probably the most important thing that's happening in health right now, but it's not the only thing that's happening in health. And so I think it's just dealing with competing priorities. So those are some of the, I guess, a few of our challenges.
Yep. Thank you.
Sure. And I think it's after 2 o'clock. I'd be happy if there's another question or if we want to wrap up.
Well, we don't have any more questions. I did have a comment that it was an excellent presentation, so I wanted to share that with you. And so, again, Adam, thank you so much for being willing to give this presentation today. If you'll send me the slides, then I will get them out to the folks who registered.
Great. Sounds good.
And again,
thanks so much
for
the invitation, Megan.
Sure.
You all have a great day.
Bye-bye.